The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. My name is Sam Livingston. I will be subbing in today for Mr. Fleury. It's the day off at headquarters for the 4th of July weekend. So everyone there has the day off, and then we get the day off on Monday over here in the UK. I suspect people are really going to be looking forward to having that extra day off after a week of Celtic Throne shows. That is a stimulating and exciting show, just watching it once, so I can only imagine what it would be like not only to perform in it multiple times, but to watch the show multiple times. So Mr. Fleury has probably seen the show at least four times this week, maybe three or four times this week. So he's having me sub in for today, and I'm thankful for the opportunity to do so. I'd like to start with a few headlines on today's show. I won't spend a ton of time going through these. Then I'll transition over into talking about the latest Russian collusion story. A few comments on that, or following that, about the Supreme Court. And I'd like to conclude today's show with some comments on patriotism on the 4th of July and Theodore Roosevelt as well. Yesterday, trending all over Twitter, was the FBI arrest of Ghislaine Maxwell. I don't know how to say her first name, so I'll say Miss Maxwell. A lot of people are wondering, why didn't this happen sooner? If you're not familiar with the story, she is Jeffrey Epstein's accomplice. She's the woman that he sent out to get these underage girls. Terrible, disgusting story. She's finally arrested by the Southern District of New York. And this is the same district where William Barr was accused of interfering by firing the head of that office, Jeffrey Berman. It doesn't seem like a coincidence that Jeffrey Berman gets fired by William Barr, and then this arrest is finally made. So a lot of people are speculating that it was actually Berman that was holding this up. But again, a lot of people are implicated in this Epstein scandal. Of course, the media will only talk about the times when Mr. Donald Trump met with Epstein. No mention of Bill Clinton actually being on his plane and on Epstein's island. Again, this entire story shows how corrupt and sick our nation is from head to toe. I thought this section of the press conference when they announced that Ms. Maxwell was arrested was interesting, because this story is not going away. In that press conference, they said, we would welcome Prince Andrew coming in to talk with us. Now, Prince Andrew has vehemently denied any association or illegal association, I guess, with Epstein and what was going on the airplane. But here, U.S. investigators would like to talk to, I believe he's the Queen's son. And already trending on Twitter, Ghislaine Maxwell didn't kill herself. So everybody is eagerly watching what happens as she is in that holding cell. The jobs report came out yesterday. This, I thought, was hilarious. Someone must be trying to sabotage Rachel Maddow's show. She needs to figure out how to clean up her research assistants or her sources. At this stage, she probably doesn't care after 3 years of peddling Russian collusion, but she started her show, and she actually seemed happy about this. I'll play a montage, and she's got a little smirk on her face. She's smiling about the jobs report and how bad it's going to be. And she's got this little side smile, because this has been the plan for the last 4 months from the radical left, is sabotage the economy to make President Trump look bad. And what we're seeing is what will most likely be a very quick recovery. Again, there's plenty of variables in that, lots of jobs that are permanently lost. But what happened, it was another record gain, 4.8 million jobs gained. And it's so funny to watch them pull this plot out to make the president look bad. And the economy is at a record high, and then it drops off at a record pace. I think it was like 9,000 points off of the Dow in less than 2 weeks or something like that. And already it's starting to shoot back up. So it's funny to watch how this backfires, because now President Trump can always say, I presided over the record jobs months in the United States. 4.8 million jobs gained back for the month of June. I wanted to play this montage that President Trump tweeted out. He loves his jobs numbers. Last month, as soon as they came out and they were higher than expected, he sprinted out to the Rose Garden to give a press conference. It was similar this time around. I'm amazed at how quickly he puts this montage together. I'll go ahead and play that clip for you right now.
Unemployment figures for June. Brace yourself. It's going to be absolutely terrible.
Blockbuster jobs report.
4.8 million jobs were added last month. 4.8 million.
And nearly 5 million jobs in June.
People are hiring.
4.8 million new jobs.
4.8 million jobs were added last month.
It actually beat estimates by a wide margin.
It is way more than the 3 million economists expected.
And it speaks to the strength of the economy.
This is news to celebrate.
It is unequivocally good news.
So it's a big positive to see this much hiring.
I see a number to be celebrated.
Adding 404,000 jobs for African Americans, 1.5 million for Hispanics, 3 million for women, and it was the biggest jump on record.
We built the greatest economy in the history of the world, and we are now doing it again.
I might have to play that again a little later in the show. I think that's the 20th time I've watched that video this morning. If anything, President Trump knows how to get momentum going and stir up some energy. I think every one of those clips was from news outlets that do not like him. They are from CNN, MSNBC, and they have to admit, yeah, this is good news. The jobs are coming back. So it backfired. He quickly gathers all of these clips together of them having to admit that there's positive news in the United States. Just sad that so many people... You look at that first clip, maybe I will play it again. Well, I'm short on time. And Rachel Maddow is half smiling at the potential that this jobs report is bad, that we didn't get any jobs, that maybe we lost more. She's smiling about that. And then you look at the face of every reporter that comes on after that and reports on the actual jobs report, and they almost look, well, they look somber. They look like they're sad to have to report that 5 million jobs were gained in the month of June, because that's good news. Moving on through the headlines, I spent a lot more time on that than I wanted to. The NFL further capitulates to the mob. It says that it will play the black national anthem before football games. I think they, in the announcement or what's leaked of that, is that they just want to do that for the first week of games. I don't know how long they're going to play that. I think every single American, regardless of skin color, was wondering, what is the black national anthem? How can we have two national anthems? The song is titled Lift Every Voice and Sing. It's a very gospel-sounding song. My big concern, not only is it all about coming out of slavery and all of that, but it's 3 minutes and 43 seconds long. So I'm not sure if they're going to try to shorten that or if they're going to have people listen to that entire thing. But again, let's get back to talking about unifying the nation and trying to prevent this rift and this division. We're really going to play two separate national anthems? That's not going to build any unity. Gun sales as well are skyrocketing. This was just shocking to see some of these numbers. The firearm background checks in 2020 are at 19.1 million for the year. And if that pace continues, that will be 40 million background checks for the year. In 2019, there were 28 million. So that's over a 10 million more background checks. And that's the biggest surge since the FBI started keeping track of those numbers. The Wall Street Journal says, if soaring gun sales are a guide, millions of Americans are with, referring to that couple in St. Louis. This week, the FBI announced a record 3.9 million background checks for June, the highest monthly total since the FBI began keeping the statistic in 1998. It's a 136% increase over June 2019. One spokesperson says 40% of these checks are for first-time gun buyers. Washington Free Beacon reports that gun sales once again set a new record for the month of June, but some retailers are reporting that the rush on guns and ammunition has drained their stock nearly dry. So we can have some positive news about the resurgence in the economy, but we can't lose sight of the underlying problems here, and that is this brewing civil war, and it is heating up. People are afraid. The police aren't coming to defend them. They're taking matters into their own hands. Along a similar vein, I thought I'd just highlight this from Tucker Carlson. This is from Forbes. They write, Tucker Carlson tonight finished the quarter as the highest rated program in all of cable news for the first time since the show's launch, delivering an average total audience of 4.331 million viewers. His show broke the record for the highest rated quarter of any cable news program ever. And I wanted to mention that because Mr. Fleury referenced him, I think it was last week, in his monologue about the silent majority and how all of those advertising agencies pulled out from his show. They said, Carlson's racist. We don't want to associate with that message. And they pull out their advertising, and his ratings have just been going up and up and up. And it's the most watched cable news program ever. Politico ran a headline this morning talking about Tucker Carlson running for the presidency in 2024. And then I thought another funny story along with this was CNN wants to come out and they're bragging about it. Tucker Carlson's show, I think it airs at 8 p.m., had more than CNN and MSNBC at that same time combined. So CNN had, I think, just about 2 million. MSNBC had 1.7, somewhere around in there. So he's beating both the other big networks combined. And then CNN comes out and says, well, our viewership is also at a record high. We're up over 120% versus last year. So apparently it was worse for them. They had less than a million viewers last year, and now they're bragging about the big increase that they've had. I read a report earlier this week that Time Warner Media is looking into selling the CNN building in Atlanta. I'm not sure if they're just downsizing. They don't have the money to support that, or they might even just want to be getting out of some of these areas like Atlanta, where a couple of weeks ago an angry mob was outside of their office breaking windows at that building. So they're not as liked as they think they are. And that wasn't a mob of right-wing extremists. That was part of the BLM riots outside of their building. So who knows what's going on there. I'd like to talk about the latest Trump-Russia collusion hit piece for a little while here. I think this story, it shouldn't be as significant as the Democrats are making it out to be, but obviously their goal in life is to do anything to make President Trump look bad. So I'll go through some of the highlights from this. We've mentioned it here and there on the program. Brent Nagtegal currently has an article up on the Trumpet website with a lot of these details as well, if you want to go ahead and read through that. On June 26th, the New York Times published an article, "Russia secretly offered Afghan militants bounties to kill U.S. troops, intelligence says." American intelligence officials have concluded that a Russian military intelligence unit secretly offered bounties to Taliban-linked militants for killing coalition forces in Afghanistan, including targeting American troops, amid the peace talks to end the long-running war there, according to officials briefed on the matter. And at this stage, well, it really shouldn't be at this stage. 3 years ago, if you read officials briefed on the matter, or if you read according to anonymous sources, you need to dismiss the story because, as we'll discuss a little later on, it is not all roads lead to Vladimir Putin. It is all roads lead to Adam Schiff. And he is the chief leaker behind a lot of these things. President Trump, the vice president as well, the director of national intelligence said, "The president was not briefed on this because we haven't verified it yet. It's an ongoing investigation between the intelligence communities, and we have not briefed him on it because we don't want this made public. We want to keep looking into it so we can find out if it's true or not." The New York Times even admits that the sources for that story came from Taliban militants who were captured, and they said the Russians were putting bounties on U.S. troops. It could very well be true, but are we going to primarily rely on what these Talibani terrorists said? So the intelligence community is working on verifying it. They want to find out how credible is this before we brief the president, before we take action on this. And then it appears in the New York Times. So the first question is, why is this being leaked? Who is leaking this to the Times? And they could really get in a lot of trouble for publishing that. If you remember back to, well, I don't actually remember this, but I've read about it. When they published the Pentagon Papers back in the 70s and right before Watergate, they were sued by the government. They had to go to court because those were confidential or classified government documents that someone stole and leaked to the New York Times. I think it was resolved and they were able to go on and continue publishing it. But I think they're comfortable leaking this because they probably know the story isn't going anywhere. It's perfect timing for another hit job on President Trump. Even the CIA, which someone noted, they do not generally issue statements. You don't often hear from the CIA. They said on June 29th that leaks compromise and disrupt the critical interagency work to collect, assess, and ascribe culpability. Essentially what they're saying is you ruined our investigation by leaking this. And if I haven't heard President Trump mention a lot about this other than to say it's just another hoax. It's another attempt to make me look bad and to ruin this presidency. But there should be investigations as to how this classified information made it yet again to the New York Times. And the initial reaction, of course, predictably, from the Democrats, from the mainstream media, is just automatically assume because an anonymous official said it, it's true. Never mind that their responsibility is to be critical, to ask the hard questions, to look into it, to vet and to verify themselves. They assume it's right because it's harmful to President Trump. And then they say, well, why didn't President Trump do anything about it? Well, he didn't know. And then they move on to, well, he's created a culture where his intelligence agencies don't want to brief him on any negative news about Russia. And they are resurrecting yet again the Trump-Russia collusion conspiracy theory. Here's a montage of their reaction to this story about the Russians supposedly putting a bounty on U.S. troops in Afghanistan.
Just as I've said to the president, with him, all roads lead to Putin. He will not, I don't know what the Russians have on the president politically, personally. financially or whatever it is.
He knew, and he didn't do anything to defend U.S. soldiers. Mind-blowing, frankly, that an American president wouldn't jump to attention, that his administration, his senior staff, his Secretary of State wouldn't jump to attention on learning that there are bounties out for American soldiers put on their heads by the Russians.
Peter suggests that he is so addled and mentally deficient right. that they didn't think it was worth their time telling him, or that he's a source of the Russians.
What I'm hearing, Nicole, from people still inside the intelligence community is that they are hesitant to even vet anti-Russia information that would be unpleasant for the president to hear. So what I want to see is public hearings.
This is a scandal. I mean, they wanted to make a big deal about Benghazi. This makes Benghazi look like playing with toys.
There may be a reluctance to brief the president on things he doesn't want to hear. Many of us do not understand his affinity for that autocratic ruler who means our nation ill.
So the idea that somehow he didn't know or isn't being briefed, it is a dereliction of duty if that's the case.
You might as well stand up and defend Russia herself, because that's what you're doing when you cover for someone who aids and abets our enemy through selfish, silent, criminal complicity, an undebatable dereliction of duty. If this is not treasonous behavior, I don't know what is.
That even when it comes to the life and death, the blood and toil of our soldiers, he could care less. Soldiers do, but it's deeply, deeply troubling when any president would put loyalty to somebody in a foreign government or to a foreign government above the health and safety of American forces.
Jim Schwede looked like he was about to cry in that interview with Susan Rice. They're so troubled by this. I would just note as well that Susan Rice hasn't been very vocal the last 2 or 3 years. And the past 2 or 3 months, when a lot of this information is coming about out about her email back in January of 2017, what she knew about the setup to get Michael Flynn, she's on the news a lot more, and she's writing her op-eds, and she's creating a lot of noise. And they're, you can tell, angry about something. They're upset that something is coming that is could really lead to them being indicted. That one segment, I think that was Senator McCaskill, this makes Benghazi look like playing with toys. We don't even know if this is true. And for them to come out and say, as soon as President Trump hears this, he needs to take action. Well, do we want a war with Russia? And for that matter, what about when President Bush responded to his intelligence agencies about weapons in Iraq? The media hated him for doing that. They said it was bad intelligence. But now we're just supposed to assume anything, any leak, any anonymous leak is hard evidence that is to be acted upon. At Benghazi, a U.S. ambassador died and 3 U.S. troops. There was no way to hide what happened there. We all saw the video and the images of that compound. And of course, it was Susan Rice who came out. Her, Ben Rhodes, they crafted their little narrative over at the White House, and Hillary Clinton at the State Department was working on her own spin. And they, you can read it in their books. They admit how they tried to spin Benghazi. It was the video maker in California, and they ran off and arrested him. It was a terrorist attack. And let's step back for a moment, since Susan Rice is so troubled by President Trump not responding to this story. During the Obama years, intelligence officials resigned because they felt their reports were being manipulated by White House staff. So they would get these briefings, they'd get them from the CIA, the NSA, they'd be compiled, and then Ben Rhodes and all the other fiction writers, they take out a few words, they reword things, and then the document would be published. This would be released. And then these people compiling the reports are saying, that's not what we said. That's not what the intelligence said. They were forced out. There are thousands of pages of reports documenting how the Obama White House manipulated intelligence about Al-Qaeda to make it look like they were being wiped out, that it wasn't a threat anymore. And if you want to talk about the president not responding to a bounty being put on U.S. troops, here is a headline from NBC News, and this is quoting a report in the Sunday Times. This is from September 5th, 2010. Iran pays $1,000 for each U.S. soldier killed by the Taliban. Iran is paying Taliban fighters $1,000 for each U.S. soldier they kill in Afghanistan, according to a report in a British newspaper. The Sunday Times described how a man, it said was a Taliban treasurer, had gone to collect $18,000 from an Iranian firm in Kabul. A reward, it said, was for an attack in July, which killed several Afghan government troops and destroyed an American armored vehicle. It goes on to talk about the tens of thousands of dollars that these Talibani militants got from Iran for killing U.S. troops and U.S.-backed troops. Do you remember Barack Obama speaking out about that? In addition to the $1,000 bounty on U.S. troops, the unnamed man said Iran paid $6,000 for the destruction of a U.S. military vehicle. Yet the schmooze campaign continued. 5-6 years. It started before Obama was even president. And the Iranians, I think, over the course of the Iraq war, were responsible for killing I think it might even be 600 U.S. troops in Iraq with these IEDs that they developed. The IRGC was backing these militias, arming them to kill U.S. troops. And Barack Obama did not stand up to Iran. Not only did he not stand up to them, he didn't just ignore the story. They're accusing President Trump of treasonous behavior for supposedly ignoring it. President Obama helped fund the murder of U.S. troops. And you can say that without reservation. Not only did he not do anything, he lifted those sanctions. And then 6 years later, after this story in 2010 breaks, he's got a pallet of cash on an airplane landing in Tehran in the middle of the night with $1.7 billion on it. I think it's something like 90% of the cash that came from the sanctions relief was funneled right into the IRGC. Responsible for the deaths of hundreds of U.S. troops. Obama funded a lot of this. And not only that, he worked alongside them in Iraq to take out ISIS. He pretty much handed them Iraq. There was no outrage by the mainstream media over that. Aren't the Iranians an enemy of the United States? And if you want to get back into Russia and talking about how bold and how strong the United States was against Russia, that's what Susan Rice's New York Times op-ed was all about. She said, if we were in this position, this is how we would have responded to the intelligence about the Russians putting a bounty on U.S. troops. We would have confronted them. There would have been action. We wouldn't have let this slide. We have 8 years of not just coddling Iran, but virtually ignoring Russia and helping in a lot of cases. You go to the big reset button with Hillary Clinton. They walked into Crimea without any pushback from the United States. Obama and Russia worked together to get the chemical weapons out of Syria. There's the missile program in Eastern Europe where Barack Obama backed off on that and he told Medvedev, just give me more time, I'll have more time after the election. Any collusion there? Russia is allowed to take uranium from Iran, enriched uranium, and supply it with unenriched uranium. I mean, they liked the Iran deal. They were profiting off of that. Then you've got the Uranium One scandal, where somehow Hillary Clinton's State Department ends up signing off on a deal that gives Russia control of uranium mines in the United States, confronting Russia. So obviously this leak about this bounty on U.S. troops in Afghanistan, that essentially ruins the investigation. A lot of people were very upset with the New York Times for running that. And now the question is, who leaked it? Who gave it to the New York Times? Well, you heard Nancy Pelosi saying, what do the Russians have on President Trump? And this is treasonous behavior. Well, as it turns out, all roads lead to Adam Schiff. And this happens over and over again. He is the head of the House Congressional Intelligence Committee. He took that seat from Devin Nunes back in 2018. And that committee is allowed to see classified intelligence. They're allowed to run their own investigations. And Adam Schiff is abusing that power. This is from The Federalist on July 2nd. Schiff learned of Russian bounty intelligence in February, withheld information from Congress, and took no action. So Adam Schiff on the Intelligence Committee is briefed on this. Someone said, hey, we know about this story. It's not verified. We're looking into it more. That was in February. And remember what's going on in February. Impeachment just ends February 5th. They're all upset about President Trump being acquitted. Then we move into coronavirus. So Adam Schiff just sits on it for a little while. He's asked what he knew. He says, I can't comment on specifics. And then suddenly the New York Times pops out with this story from officials briefed on the matter. Again, this is exactly what Adam Schiff did in July of last year that triggered the impeachment saga. He colluded with the leaker in the National Security Council. His staff were working with him on how to set this up to make it look like President Trump was now colluding with Ukraine. They'll do whatever they have to do to take him down. If you want more details on this story, again, like I said, Brent Nagtegal has an article on thetrumpet.com. It's titled, New York Times, Russia Put Bounties on American Forces in Afghanistan. And he makes a good point about how President Trump wants to move U.S. troops out of Afghanistan, and that's something that would likely get him a lot of positive news in the United States, a vote-getting maneuver, and that the Democrats want to do anything they can to thwart that. So they want to make it look like, well, he's just moving out of there because he doesn't want to confront Russia. What does Vladimir Putin have on him? New York Times has not come out and corrected their story. And again, Brent goes through that history with the Obama administration and just the hypocrisy from the radical left. We covered a little bit this week here and there about a lot of these Supreme Court decisions. I think one that's another one that's really significant. There was the first one about the LGBT and Justice Roberts and Neil Gorsuch saying you can't discriminate against them. And then there was the DACA decision that Justice Roberts said, Barack Obama can create something by fiat, but President Trump isn't allowed to take it away by fiat. And then earlier this week, Justice Roberts struck again. He was the deciding factor in a 5-4 decision about knocking down this law in Louisiana that was passed by the state's legislature. So this is what the people of the state wanted. And I'll get into this in just a minute. It's not even about abortions. The United States has moved beyond having the debate about the legality of abortions, and it's moved on to, just trying to regulate that. So the whole story, like I said at the beginning, this whole country, it's sick from head to toe what is now legal in the United States. And then to the extent that They don't even, they're happy to regulate every other little thing in your life. But when it comes to abortions now, I mean, it's, you just do what you have to do. It doesn't matter if the doctor is licensed. He doesn't need to have a clinic that's nearby a hospital. He, well, I'll get into those details in just a second. But the woman who passed this or introduced this law in Louisiana, her name is Katrina Jackson. She wrote an article in USA Today. I wrote Louisiana's pro-life law. The Supreme Court ruled against women's health. And she goes on to talk about how this wasn't even about abortion. This was about regulating clinics so that they're sanitary, so that they're registered with a hospital, and that the clinic needs to be located within 30 miles of a hospital. Because when the procedures go wrong, the woman needs to be transported to a hospital. And generally what happens is the clinician just calls 911 and then leaves the woman there. She's taken away in an ambulance, and then she needs to be re-diagnosed for what the problem is. Again, the whole system is disgusting. But what the Supreme Court said was, we don't want any of those restrictions because it might make getting an abortion more difficult. So by all means, if you need to be in that clinic that has no safety regulations, that's fine, because we cannot get in the way of your ability to get an abortion. And this woman who introduced this law is simply saying, we hold every other clinic in the state of Louisiana to these standards. If you perform surgery, these are the regulations you have to abide by, but not so for the abortion clinics. And this woman, she says she's a Black Democrat female lawyer and a former abortionist. So she's right in the middle of this industry. And what Justice Roberts said was, we can't do anything to regulate this industry. It needs to be free to do what it wants. And Justice Roberts didn't agree with that position 4 years ago, but he didn't have to take a stand. He could just lay low and he could side with the conservatives and no one would draw any attention to him because his vote wasn't a deciding vote. I think it was still Anthony Kennedy at that time. But now it's Chief Roberts who is the traitor to the conservative movement, and he just keeps hopping on board with the radical left. Andrew McCarthy goes on a good solid rant about Justice Roberts and what he was doing here. And he says, this wasn't even about women's rights. This case was brought to the court not by women who were worried about, I don't even want to say that it's a right, who were worried about abortion being taken away. It was brought by these clinics who said they were acting on behalf of the women. And really what that is they just didn't want to have to move their clinic. They didn't want to have to clean it up. And McCarthy talks about how Roberts continually betrays the court. And Roberts made a decision earlier this week where he sided with conservatives, but it wasn't even a big deal. So he's got, and it wasn't a huge case, but then the left scolded him for siding with the conservatives on this issue. Slate wrote that John Roberts just bulldozed the wall separating church and state. So Roberts does not get any sympathies for compromising. And I speculate there's probably something more sinister than just a man compromising here. These decisions that he's making are horrendous and are not guided by any methodology. McCarthy says, Democrats fully grasp that the court is a political institution. Their supporters demand that they see it as a vehicle for imposing the left's policy agenda. Their senators conduct confirmation hearings that way, and their judges decide cases that way. Whether that requires, in any given case, being a living constitution enthusiast, an originalist, a strict constructionist, a post-sovereign one-worlder, a states' rights federalist, or a devotee of stare decisis, they do not see the court as an institution for deciding legal cases under the law. They see it as a tool for achieving results that they can then portray as immutable constitutional mandates. They will use whatever methodology they need to get their way. And really, the methodology is not even there. They just use that as an excuse They know exactly what decisions they're going to make before they even hear the case. And then it's a matter of, well, how do we justify it when we write the court's opinion? And one day, if that requires us to be a living constitutionalist, and we have to invent substantive due process to say that this word includes all these rights, so be it. And if the next day we need to be an Antonin Scalia originalist and take the word by its strict definition, we'll do that if it means we get our way. So there's a lot going on in the Supreme Court. I'd like to refer you back to Mr. Gerald Fleury's article in January 2019, "Is America's Supreme Court in Bible Prophecy?" And you just look at these decisions, and President Trump is not winning in these decisions. So you wonder if it will take another term in office for Mr. Trump to solidify conservative control of the court. So again, that article is titled, "Is America's Supreme Court in Bible Prophecy?" I'd like to talk a little bit about the 4th of July. That will be tomorrow. And obviously there is this, well, you could just call it not even a culture war, but the start of a civil war in the United States. And I think it's especially upsetting to see these academics and these scholars get on TV and condemning figures in history as if they themselves are so righteous and they would have known what decisions to make at that time. I enjoyed reading this tweet. This is from a Princeton professor. He posted this on Twitter. His name is Robert George. He says, "I sometimes ask students what their position on slavery would have been had they been white and living in the South before abolition. Guess what? They all would have been abolitionists. They all would have bravely spoken out against slavery and worked tirelessly against it. Of course, this is nonsense. Only the tiniest fraction of them, or any of us, would have spoken up against slavery or lifted a finger to free the slaves. Most of them and us would have gone along. Many would have supported the slave system and happily benefited from it. So I respond by saying that I will credit their claims if they can show evidence of the following: that, in leading their lives today, they have stood up for the rights of unpopular victims of injustice whose very humanity is denied, and where they have done so knowing that it would make them unpopular with their peers, that they would be loathed and ridiculed by powerful, influential individuals and institutions in our society, that they would be abandoned by many of their friends, that they would be called nasty names, and that they would risk being denied valuable professional opportunities as a result of their moral witness. In short, my challenge is to show where they have at risk to themselves and their futures stood up for a cause that is unpopular in elite sectors of our culture today. Who stands up to the mob? Who is willing to give up their business, their livelihood, to fight for the truth? Well, a lot of people today look and judge the past and say, well, I wouldn't have done it that way. Well, those same people today are not standing up for the truth. They are the sheep, and they are going along with the mob. And I think it's especially important to just think about that spiritually and standing up for what's right. It makes you unpopular. It isn't the easy way. I wanted to go through some highlights from Mr. Gerald Fleury's article, "Saving America from the Radical Left Temporarily." And I think this context makes the 4th of July more significant, at least in my mind. I think, you know, before I was into this a lot when I was young as a teenager, it was just America's awesome because it's America and it's awesome and the military's big and we're just really proud and it seemed more like a surface level understanding of why America was great, why America and Britain were great. And really, when you know and understand Bible prophecy and you understand what God is working out with these nations, it makes this history, it makes these days more profound. This is what Mr. Fleury wrote in that article. He says, "You need to understand the real reasons why America has been the greatest nation in history. No man can make America great again, certainly not if he is ignorant of the fact that it was God who made it great and ignorant about why he did so. God has blessed America like no other nation, and the devil wants to destroy America like no other nation. As I prove in my free booklet, America Under Attack, Satan is marshaling every tool and weapon he can to wreck this nation, and he is having alarming success. This evil spiritual power is influencing the radical left. Most Republicans don't realize what they are dealing with, people who are absolutely committed to destroying the government of this land." And again, go through America Under Attack. I've been really excited to get back into the United States and Britain and prophecy, especially after the Celtic Throne musical. That history and understanding these incredible blessings that America and Britain experience. And I've just been in awe of how resilient those blessings are, that we could have our economies locked down for 4 or 5 months, that we could have race riots in the United States, that there's division like there is, yet we are still the most blessed people on earth. I was talking to my wife about that and just how well we eat, despite all of the difficulties going on in our nations, especially at Edstone, you wouldn't know anything's wrong. And that all gets back to Abraham. It gets back to his obedience. It gets back to why God made that promise to him. And it also gets back to this temporary saving, this temporary resurgence. As God is exposing the radical left, he's giving people a chance to see that corruption. He's giving people more time to repent. Like I was talking about earlier with just all of those scandals at the beginning of the show. I mean, unless there is that national repentance, like Mr. Fleury spoke about in his Key of David on Abraham Lincoln, I mean, there are very dark times ahead, but we have to even look beyond that. We have to look to the world tomorrow. And again, that's what makes the United States and Britain and prophecy so special. Understanding why America was great in the first place and what God has in mind for it in the future. I wanted to comment on Theodore Roosevelt. His name has been in the news a lot more. His statue is coming down in New York City. Mayor Bill de Blasio said, "I think Roosevelt himself is another one of these complex figures in American history. He did some extraordinarily progressive things that we feel to this day, and he did some things that I think are deeply troubling." Well, I think Bill de Blasio has done a lot of things that are deeply troubling, and I wonder if there's even a lot of jealousy when people go back and study these figures, because they accomplished so much. They often had to stand by themselves to stand up for the truth, and there aren't a lot of people that are willing to do that today. So they go back and they vilify them, and they talk about how great they are, because, well, I wouldn't have done it that way. Well, it's nice to have 200 years of hindsight to make that judgment. Theodore Roosevelt was put on Mount Rushmore. He wasn't a founding father of the United States, but he embodied the American spirit. He was in New York City when that city was blooming onto the world scene. The Statue of Liberty was being built while he was there, the Brooklyn Bridge, all of these symbols of Americana. He's right in the midst of it. And then he, as an state assemblyman, he's traveling out west and he's running his cattle ranch in North Dakota. He is a man of immense energy, a dynamo. I'm going through Edmund Morris's book on Teddy Roosevelt, and he really loved Manifest Destiny. He wrote, I think it's a 7-part series titled Winning the West. I'd really like to get into that. And this was all before he was even president. And when he was president, he made sure that that mantra, winning the West, continued. And he felt that, you know, we need the Panama Canal, we need the Philippines, we need to secure our footing in the world. And it's so frustrating to hear this history get labeled and dismissed because it's racist. And I think there's, or they claim that it's racist. And I think there is a lot of a parallel there when you look at the turn of the century and that 2,520-year blessing occurring in the year 1800, and you've got physical Israel now looking back at that time and saying they were all racist, they're all slave owners, pull the statues down, throw blood on them, racist. And then you look at what happened with the church and the worldwide Church of God and what those individuals were saying about the United States and Britain in prophecy and Mystery of the Ages. They called that a racist book. They hate this history. Well, I want to play this clip for you. We're quickly running out of time. This is from a documentary that was made in 1983. It's free if you have Amazon Prime. I watched it a few months ago and I loved it. This is the introduction to it, and I wanted to play it because it starts with Teddy Roosevelt keeping the 4th of July, and it talks about the scene at that time. It's a long clip, but I think that you'll enjoy it.
It is a season of celebration. Born in revolution, the United States has conquered a continent known the anguish of civil war. Now, in the early years of the 20th century, the young nation is a world power, proudly parading on July 4th, its birthday. A parade is clear evidence that the marchers know where they're going, usually down Main Street into the town square. There, John Philip Sousa leads the band. Politicians point with pride. And children at last get their fill of lemonade before the fireworks begin. Like any good holiday, the 4th of July in 1905 is a day off. To picnic in the park, promenade on a seaside boardwalk, or just gawk at the crowd. The really adventurous may even go into the water, provided, of course, that their bathing attire does not offend public morals. Like the rest of the nation, the President of the United States and his family celebrate freedom with firecrackers.
Good evening, everyone.
Against the sound and fury, Theodore Roosevelt is a fitting symbol of America's belief in its destiny. Of himself, he says, "I rose like a rocket." Most popular president since George Washington, Roosevelt has turned national politics into theater, challenging every citizen to play a role. He demands that America live up to its great mission in the world. With evangelical zeal and frequent platitudes, he preaches a straight and narrow path to national virtue. "Keep your eyes on the stars," he says, "but keep your feet on the ground." A master of communication, he is among the first to perform for an instrument which will change politics forever, the motion picture camera. Whether shaking 50 hands a minute in Washington or barnstorming across America, Roosevelt radiates the energies which captivate the country. He laughs loudly at his own jokes, plays games with the children while diplomats wait, dismays his guards with an impromptu plunge in a submarine. has hunted buffalo and grizzly bears, captured robbers, led the Rough Riders on San Juan Hill. Already he has written more than a dozen books on history, nature, and political philosophy. One of them dictated while shaving. He believes, he says, in the strenuous life. Theodore Roosevelt is not only the President of the United States, he is the most entertaining man in America, and the people love him.
What a different time that was. That's the history that needs to be blotted out, according to Mayor Bill de Blasio. Complex figure. He was deeply troubling. Well, you watch that documentary and you read these books about Teddy Roosevelt, and that man embodied Americana. He is a dynamo, just filled with positive energy and patriotism and excitement for his country and what he believed his country could do for the world. Focus on the positives. Think about America and Britain being the first nations to outlaw the millennia-old practice of slavery. Think about the sacrifices that were made to bring those things about. I know the 4th of July is about American independence from Britain, but at the end of the day, these nations are brothers, and we're all part of that promise to Abraham. Think about the rule of law. Think about the positives in these nations, and think about how much better it will be in the world tomorrow when our peoples obey God's law. These are the blessings that came from Abraham, and he obeyed God's law. And look at the physical blessings that our nations received because of that. Imagine an entire country obeying God's law and coming under his government. Celebrate the United States and Britain in prophecy. Celebrate the positives of that history. Learn from the negatives and be captivated by the vision in that book. That's all I have time for today. I hope you enjoy your 4th of July weekend. If you have any comments for the show, you can email those to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us, and we'll see you next week.